This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. Whether you're in the mood for a musical remembrance or an historical gallery exhibit, it's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. When rock and roll and songwriting Hall of Famer Alan Toussaint passed away unexpectedly in November while on tour in Spain, he left one of the richest legacies in the history of New Orleans music, a treasure trove of great songs, recordings, and performances that will forever have a hand in defining New Orleans in the popular imagination. WWNO's Fred Kasten has this Alan Toussaint remembrance.
I went up to it and to this huge instrument and pressed a couple of keys and got a sound out of it immediately, and I just thought that was fantastic. It was love at first touch.
New Orleans pianist, songwriter, producer, arranger, and performer Alan Toussaint got that first touch of piano at home at age 6.
My sister was being given a piano by from my aunt, who thought it was really dignified for a young lady to learn the piano or violin. My father and some of his friends went to get it on one of those old flatbed trucks. We lived on a very bumpy street, and as they were bringing this piano home, I could hear it all the way down at the end of the block. Every time it would hit a bump, you could hear some sounds coming out of a piano, and I fell in love with that sound as I heard it coming.
On the heels of the piano's arrival at the Toussaint home came a teacher hired to give Alan's sister weekly lessons, lessons which she never really warmed up to.
But I loved it because I got a chance to hear the piano right in the house being played. And as soon as her teacher would leave, she would get up from the piano and I would get right to the piano and try and mimic what I heard them doing. And I'd ask her to show me whatever I was playing, where it was on the page. And she'd show me the really basic ABCs of music in that way.
Alan Toussaint eventually got lessons of his own at the Xavier Junior School of Music, but his mother discontinued those after about 6 months on account of Alan's inclination to spend more time learning to play the latest songs on the radio than practicing his lesson pieces. At that point, though, Alan had absorbed enough to keep on teaching himself and even start writing music by the time he was about 12.
After I had played most of the things at the moment that I knew that was out and about, something in you always called for something to be brought forth. And I began writing melodies of my own. I spent a lot of time, however, listening to music and mimicking, taking the recordings right next to the piano and trying to slow them down and get the licks and the chords. I learned so much from the radio and records as a boy.
Turns out there were other youngsters in Toussaint's Kurtown neighborhood tracking the same muse.
We developed a neighborhood band called the Flamingos, which had members in it like Ferd Eaglin, Snooks the blind guitarist, genius of a guy. He was our guitarist and bass player, even though there was no bass, but he played bass on the guitar. He didn't need a piano either with all the guitar he played, but they were stuck with me. And Benjamin Gregory, who lived next door, was on tenor saxophone. Frank Moten, who lived around the corner, was another saxophonist and clarinetist. Walter Lang was our trumpet player. Ferdinand Bijou was the trombone player. James Jackson was our drummer. We had a neighborhood band that began to become fairly popular among teenagers and even a little more.
Alan Toussaint was about 14 when the Flamingos first got together, which was also about the period he got to know old-time New Orleans musician Ernest Penn, who patiently taught Alan some of the intricate secrets of stride piano. Toussaint was also completely taken by the great and highly innovative records Hey Little Girl, Tipitina, for instance. Professor Longhair was putting out round about that time. A chance to sub for Huey Piano Smith on a Dewdrop Inn gig one night brought young Toussaint's talents to the attention of older rhythm and blues players. And before long, he left school to tour with Shirley and Lee and started working regularly with artists the likes of Earl King and Tommy Ridgely. Toussaint got to know lots of singers and got in the habit of having them come by his house to rehearse, experience which paid off big time when Minute Records launched a serious talent search in New Orleans.
And they were holding auditions, and I went over to play behind the various artists because most of them who was auditioning, I knew them from coming to the house. At that audition that evening, the people of Minute asked me would I come and make the music for them until their permanent person would come who was going to be Harold Baptiste. And I said yes, and that's what launched me into record business as an A&R man, which later on we called producer.
Back in April at the French Quarter Festival's Let Them Talk interview series, Alan Toussaint reminisced with music historian John Broven and singer and guitarist Deacon John about early sessions in Cosmo Matassa's studio, including the date that produced the Ernie Cato number one hit, Mother-in-Law.
We always recorded four songs on each session, and it was done in 3 hours. If you're recording an album, then 6 hours. That's the difference in nowadays, 6 months as opposed to 6 hours. That day we did Mother-in-Law, won a $10,000 reward, maybe Tainted the Truth, and something else. But we had a wonderful time. However, when I first wrote Mother-in-Law, and I had it just the way I thought it should go, and I first introduced it to Cato when he came over, and the guys who would sing backup, whoever was in the room, was Willie Harper, Calvin LeBlanc, Benny Spellman. And when I first introduced the song to Ernie Cato, and he heard it, and when he gave his go at it, he began to shout like Archie Brown with the Blind Boys. He used to like to shout like a preacher. And that just wasn't the air for what I had in mind. And he was so committed to that kind of thing. So I say, well, I'll dismiss this song. And I just balled that up and threw it in the trash can like I did many things. However, Willie Harper, he thought this was a really good song. He got it out and said, Cato, we do that many times, just throw them away. But give it another try because this is going to be a good song, man. And Cato finally resolved to slow it down and not shout and just tolerate it until it was over, which you might say. And I'm so glad that Willie Harper took it out because I didn't take it as seriously as Willie Harper did. When Willie heard it, he thought, this is it.
Yes. And Alan, another person very important to that recording was Benny Spellman.
Oh, yes. Benny Spellman was the voice who, when we did the song, it was written with combinations where this go there and one go there and this goes there. And Benny Spellman was the voice that said, Mother-in-law. And Calvin and Willie said, Mother-in-law. And Cato said, the worst person I know. Benny, Mother-in-law. Calvin and Willie, Mother-in-law. That went on till the whole thing was over. And Benny, when the record came out and began to do very well, Benny convinced us that the reason that this was such a big hit was had nothing to do with Cato. Or me writing, but that boy, Mother-in-law, said, the way they hear that, this is it. And based on that, he bought a brand new green convertible Cadillac. Mother-in-law. And he was gigging based on he did the bass voice on Mother-in-law. And he did it so much till he convinced me that I need to write him a song that he can do his famous baritone voice, because he used to flex his muscles a lot too. And so I wrote Lipstick Traces for him just so he can get to the line. Well, it goes Lipstick Traces on a cigarette, et cetera, et cetera. I'm so in love with you, don't leave me no more, Mother-in-law. So I got Benny off my back.
Alan Toussaint's stature as one of America's best songwriters and producers has stood the test of time from those early 60s hits to now. His talent for crafting simple, memorable melodies, astute observations, poetic sensibilities, and unparalleled capacity to imbue his songs with the spirit, rhythm, sound, and flavor of New Orleans has left us with a body of work to continue to celebrate and explore. Here is Alan Toussaint from his Connected CD with the title tune, We Are All Connected.
Knowing we're all related and well created, to celebrate this gift of life. We are all connected like the links in an unbroken chain. Each time we hurt someone or something, there's a part of us that feels the pain.
We all hurt.
We all hurt.
Great Alan Toussaint, We Are All Connected, from his highly recommended mid-90s Connected. Alan Toussaint passed away back in November while on tour in Spain. He was 77. For 89.9 WWNO, I'm Fred Caston.
You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio. I'm Diane Mack. His may not be a household name, but architect Henry Howard left a permanent mark on our city's landscape. The Irish native called New Orleans home for nearly half a century, and now a new exhibit at the Historic New Orleans Collection takes a look at the city through Howard's eyes, in An Architect and His City, Henry Howard's New Orleans, 1837 to 1884. Joining me now is Director of Museum Programs, John Lawrence. Welcome to Inside the Arts.
Hello, Diane. It's always a pleasure to be here.
How is it that Henry Howard's contributions to our architectural landscape are not so well known?
In the book that we published earlier this year with Princeton Architectural Press, which is a very close examination of Howard's life, Robert Brantley, the author, goes into that. And through a series of unfortunate circumstances, Howard was forced to sell off his library of architectural drawings and his physical library of books toward the end of his life in order to pay for his declining health. So Robert was able to follow those drawings only so far after they escaped Howard's notice. And so the paper trail that an architect can leave in an obvious way with drawings and plans and building commissions that are well documented was not necessarily there in Howard's case. What was there, though, is more of a hidden record in the public records of New Orleans, the notarial archives in particular, where his contracts with individuals were recorded. And so through a close examination of archival sources, Robert Brantley and his co-authors, Jan White Brantley and Victor McGee, were able to give us a great sense of Howard's accomplishments.
Who was this 19th century architect?
Henry Howard was a native of Cork in Southern Ireland. His father was a builder. And from the little remnant that we have of Howard's early life, which is mostly in a biographical sketch he wrote in the early 1870s, we know that he studied building and the mechanical trades in a formal setting in Cork. He also learned a lot from his father, but his goal as a young man was to travel to the United States and become an architect, to study with an American architect and ultimately practice on his own. He arrives in New York in 1836, but only finds work making picture frames. But he does become exposed to James Dakin, an architect working in New York who later worked in New Orleans. After New York, Howard comes to New Orleans kind of at the top of the skill level of a carpenter or joiner. We might call him a finished carpenter today. He could do everything in the realm of carpentry, including make staircases, which was viewed as among the most complex tasks that a carpenter could undertake. In the early city directories during Howard's time in New Orleans, the late 1830s, he's listed as a carpenter, and those listings change gradually. He becomes a builder, and then at some time in the 1840s, he begins to list himself as an architect.
Now, when he arrived in New Orleans in 1837, what was going on in the city?
Well, the city was gripped with the financial panic that began in a failure of the cotton markets in New Orleans, a panic that spread throughout the United States and Europe. And so it wasn't necessarily an auspicious time for Howard to arrive. He also enters a city that is much more compact than New Orleans we know today and consisted of three municipalities or three municipal districts: the area below Esplanade, the French Quarter between Esplanade and Canal Street, and then from Canal Street up to about Felicity Street, at which point the city of Lafayette began. And so Howard enters into this sort of compact city, but one that is on the verge of exploding with commerce varying from everything from the cotton and sugar markets to the domestic slave trade, which flourished in New Orleans during this period. Howard sees this transformation of a city. In 1852, those three municipalities consolidate under a single government, and New Orleans begins its annexation of these other governmental enclaves. And so the city of Lafayette, the city of Jefferson, the town of Carrollton, Algiers ultimately form the modern city of New Orleans that we know today. And this is achieved about a decade before Howard's death in 1884. So he sees the city being built in a governmental sense as well as a physical and building sense.
Now, where do we find his designs or his works today? Are they right under our noses?
They are. It's believed that Howard designed a little over 250 different buildings in the course of his career. And these are small private residences. They are grand public buildings. They are churches. They are modest size public buildings. Within the area of New Orleans, there are about six dozen of these buildings that still remain. Among them are the Pontalba buildings, for example. There are a number of grand urban homes that exist. The Dufour House on Esplanade Avenue, for example, a really large and impressive late 1850s design by Howard. Outside of New Orleans, perhaps the best known building of his that survives is Maidwood Plantation in Napoleonville, a house that he designed in the late 1840s.
Did he have a hand in building any of the houses in the Garden District?
Yes, the Short Villa on Britannia Street, and there are any number of grand Garden District homes that Howard had a hand in designing.
So now, what are some of the highlights of the exhibit?
There is a section on architectural books that give an understanding of how one learned to be an architect. We have to realize that it wasn't until the late 1860s when a university-level program in architecture was established at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology that people could actually study to be an architect. And so one whole section of the exhibit is of books that architects or people aspiring to be architects would have found useful. These are pattern books, buildings that are laid out in a book form that give you plans, that give you elevations, that focus on what was popular at the time. There are much more technical manuals, ones that deals, for example, with how to build a staircase. There are any number of books that focus on the classical orders of architecture. I think these are an important way to understand how Howard used this knowledge to educate himself and to make the buildings that he did. Another section of the exhibit contains many city directories, and these are the phone books before there were telephones, and the city directories kind of, in their aggregate, give a sense of texture of New Orleans at the time, where people were dispersed throughout the city, what other businesses were involved in providing things that an architect would use, whether it was a stone yard or a lumber yard or the provider of Welsh slates or an ironmonger. All of these things were critical to understanding how buildings were put together and give a sense of the city's history. Throughout the exhibition, there are also nearly two dozen contemporary photographs by Robert and Jan Brantley of Howard's surviving works. And these serve a visual anchor, if you will, to the New Orleans that we could not replicate. Part of the exhibition is an interactive timeline that lays out throughout the course of his nearly 50-year career the dates of construction of these nearly 250 buildings that are his life's work. And so I think when we begin to think about how hard it might be to design one house, to design 250 buildings of various capacities, various scales, various functions, you really understand what a special architectural talent that Henry Howard was.
John Lawrence, Director of Museum Programs with the Historic New Orleans Collection. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Diane.
An Architect and His City, Henry Howard's New Orleans, is on view through April 2016 at the Historic New Orleans Collection, 533 Royal Street. That's our show for this week. Inside the Arts is a production of WWNO. Our program is archived at WWNO.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette next Tuesday at 1 p.m. when we'll go Inside the Arts. Happy New Year! I'm Diane Mack.